founded and built into a huge success. Some sons opt out altogether and don't even try to compete. Others are content to manage what their fathers have already built. A few sons set out to outdo their fathers at the same game, and that may be the toughest thing of all, particularly when the father's name is Conrad Hilton. Barron's first major responsibility, back in 1959, was to run Hilton's carte blanche credit card business, which they just bought. He screwed it up, and carte blanche lost millions of dollars over the next 6 years. Hilton finally threw in the towel in 1966 and sold out to Citibank. In 1967, Barron convinced his father to sell Hilton's international hotel division to TWA in exchange for TWA stock, which was selling for about $90 a share. There was just one problem, OPEC. Almost immediately, oil prices started going through the roof, which devastated the airlines. Within 18 months, TWA stock had dropped by half, and by 1974 it was down to $5 a share. Until Carl Icahn took control of the company and turned it around recently, the stock was worth far less than it should have been. On the other hand, the international hotels that Hilton sold, which were recently sold again for close to $1 billion, did great business. They earned about $70 million in 1983, almost as much as Hilton earned from all its American hotels the same year. That's partly because Hilton, resting on its past reputation, had lost considerable ground in the luxury market to more aggressive competitors, such as Marriott and Hyatt. The once great Hilton name ceased being synonymous with the best in hotels. Barron Hilton did make one decision that proved successful, getting into casino gambling. In 1972, Hilton purchased two Nevada casinos for about $12 million, the Las Vegas Hilton and the Flamingo Hilton. Together, the two casinos began to account for a growing percentage of Hilton's profits. 30% in 1976, 40% in 1981, and 45%, or some $70 million, in 1985. Despite that success, Barron couldn't seem to make up his mind about Atlantic City. Hilton purchased a site at the marina around the time gambling was legalized, began moving forward, stopped suddenly, and then started again half-heartedly. By the time Hilton finally committed to construction in 1984, most of its major Nevada competitors, including Bally, Caesars, Harrah's, Sands, and the Golden Nugget, already had their facilities up, operating, and earning huge profits in Atlantic City. I have to say this much for Hilton. Having finally made the commitment, it left no doubt it was going all out. With an 8-acre site, one of the biggest in town, Hilton was determined to build on a grand scale. A huge, majestic entrance, ceilings 30 feet high, a 3,000-car self-park garage. Hilton described the project in its annual report as the largest undertaking in our history. With a casino of some 60,000 square feet and a 615-room hotel above it, the facility was comparable in size to Harrah's at Trump Plaza, which at the time was one of the largest in town. The difference was that Hilton's master plan included a second-phase expansion to some 100,000 feet of casino space and more than 2,000 guest rooms. Hungry to start recouping its investment as soon as possible, Hilton began construction at the same time it filed for a gaming license. As I explained earlier, the risk of getting turned down for a license midway through construction was the reason I'd gone after licensing first. But everyone else had done it Hilton's way, and I could understand Hilton's confidence about licensing. For starters, it was already licensed in Nevada. In addition, at a time when virtually no other construction was going on in Atlantic City, Hilton was making a huge investment in a mostly undeveloped part of town. Perhaps most important, in a business scarcely known for attracting Boy Scout companies, the Hilton name was about as all-American as you could hope to find. The licensing process seemed like little more than a formality for Hilton. The problem was that the Hilton people got a little too smug and full of themselves. They assumed they were doing Atlantic City a favor by coming to town, when in fact the licensing authorities see it just the opposite way. The burden of demonstrating suitability for a license rests entirely with the applicant, no matter who it is. Hilton took the view that it was entitled to a license. It was a critical mistake. I began to hear rumblings that Hilton was in trouble early in 1985. Atlantic City is a very political town, and everyone who does business there knows that. Hilton, trying to be smart, hired a very political lawyer. On the face of it, that seemed like a savvy move. However, according to people I knew who were familiar with the Hilton licensing hearings, it may have backfired. The second mistake Hilton made was ignoring the experience of previous applicants. Playboy, for example, had been turned down for a license 3 years before. The reason, at least in part, was its past associations with a lawyer named Sidney Korshak, who supposedly had a history of organized crime connections. For 10 years, he'd also been on retainer to Hilton at $50,000 a year to help negotiate labor disputes. I have no idea whether Korshak is a good guy or a bad guy, but the only issue that matters is pleasing the commissioners. They'd made it very clear that they didn't like Korshak. Instead of quietly severing the tie, Hilton kept Korshak on his retainer right up until the Division of Gaming Enforcement raised specific objections to him in mid-1984. Virtually the next day, Hilton fired Korshak. Barron later acknowledged to the commission that he'd taken the action only because we know how strongly you people feel about the matter. That was the worst thing he could have said. As one of the commissioners who voted against licensing Hilton put it later, the corporation apparently didn't get religion until it was pounding on the pearly gates of licensure. It didn't help when Barron later testified that Korshak had never interceded on Hilton's behalf to prevent certain unions from striking Hilton's hotels. Within weeks of that testimony, Korshak wrote Barron a letter, which he released to the media. It described in great detail exactly the work he'd done for Hilton in Las Vegas. It also included copies of letters Barron Hilton had written thanking Korshak for his efforts. The end of Korshak's letter was devastating. "You have caused me irreparable harm," he wrote Barron, "and as long as I live, I will never forget that. When did I become a shady character? I imagine when you were having difficulty getting a license in Atlantic City." Hilton might have survived everything if Barron himself had taken the licensing hearings more seriously. Instead, he virtually ignored them. One of the few times he saw fit to show up in New Jersey was for his own testimony before the Casino Control Commission. Nor were any of his top corporate executives there for most of the hearings. On February 14, 1985, I was in my office when I got a phone call from a guy named Al Glasgow, who publishes a newsletter about the gaming industry called Atlantic City Action. Al is a true Damon Runyon character who lives and breathes gaming. He knows as much as anyone in town about who's doing what to whom. "Did you hear about Hilton?" Al asked. I said, "No, what?" And he said, "They just got turned down for a license." I thought he was kidding at first. Approval requires the concurrence of 4 commissioners. Hilton won a majority, but as was the case with Hugh Hefner, 3-2 in favor was a loss, not a win. In any case, Al said he suspected there was a possibility Hilton might just decide to put the facility up for sale, rather than try to fight for a rehearing. Hilton was scheduled to open the hotel in less than 12 weeks. They'd already hired more than 1,000 employees, and they were adding at the rate of approximately 100 people a day. By opening day, they'd have approximately 4,000 people on the payroll. With that payroll, and no income coming in, you're talking catastrophe, no matter how big the company. At the very least, Hilton was under severe time pressure to get an appeal heard by the commission. Even so, I assumed that with more than $300 million already invested, they were going to do whatever they could to try to get licensed. After talking with Glasgow and a few other people in Atlantic City, I decided to call Barron Hilton out in California. As much as anything else, it was a condolence call. You couldn't help feeling sorry for the man. "Hi, Baron. How are you?" I said. Not surprisingly, Baron replied, "Not well, not well at all." "I can imagine," I went on, "because what happened is just too bad." "I've got to tell you, Donald," he said, "that I didn't expect it. It caught me totally by surprise." I told him that the move had caught everyone by surprise, and the conversation just went on like that. Before hanging up, I got to the business part of the call. "Look, Baron," I said, "I have no idea what you want to do with this facility, but if for some reason you're thinking of selling it, I'd be interested in buying it, if the price is right." Baron said he'd keep that in mind, and he thanked me for calling. I think he genuinely appreciated it. I also figured that was as far as things would get. Hilton already had plans to file for a rehearing, and I still believed that the commission would eventually reverse its decision. At the beginning of March, I got a call from a friend named Benjamin Lambert, who runs East Dill Realty. I first met Lambert 10 years before, when I was just beginning to look for a hotel chain partner for the Commodore Hotel deal. He made some suggestions, and over the years, Ben and I worked on several deals together. We had our disagreements, but the bottom line was that we were friends. As it happened, Ben was a member of Hilton's board of directors. In the weeks after Hilton was turned down for a license, we talked a few times about the situation. Ben believed Hilton ought to seriously consider selling. On this occasion, Ben was calling to invite me to a party he was holding for the Hilton board at his townhouse, prior to their annual meeting that week in New York. As he put it, "It's not an inopportune time for you and Baron to meet about current events." The board, it turned out, was deeply split about how to handle the Atlantic City situation. The Casino Control Commission had just agreed to the rehearing Hilton had requested on licensing. Nonetheless, several board members, including Ben, believed that it made more sense to sell the facility immediately, if the right buyer could be found. Their argument was that if the commission didn't reverse itself and grant Hilton a license, the consequences could be truly disastrous for the company. By that point, a couple of months down the line, they'd be carrying several thousand employees. Worse, by selling the hotel under pressure, they might get a bad price. I went to the party, and Ben introduced me to Baron, whom I'd never met in person. We ended up walking out to the garden and talking alone together. Once again, the conversation was nonspecific. Mostly, Baron vented his frustration about Atlantic City, while I listened sympathetically. Baron is wary and reserved by nature. He's not the kind of guy who makes impulsive decisions, so I played it very low-key. We got along very well, and afterward, I heard from Ben that Baron felt very comfortable with me. There are times when you have to be aggressive, but there are also times when your best strategy is to lie back. Very shortly after that, Steve Wynn of the Golden Nugget decided to make a full-scale assault on Hilton, seeking control of the company. It was probably the best thing that could have happened to me. If it hadn't been for Wynn, I seriously doubt that Baron Hilton would ever have made a deal with me or anyone else for his Atlantic City Hotel Casino. On April 14th, Wynn wrote Baron a letter offering to buy a block of stock amounting to 27% of the entire Hilton company for $72 a share. At the time, the stock was trading for approximately $67 a share. Wynn also said he was prepared, if his initial offer was accepted, to pay the same $72 per share to all Hilton shareholders. Ironically, Wynn could never have gone after the company at all if it hadn't been for Conrad Hilton. When Conrad died in 1979, he totally screwed Baron. There's no nicer way to say it. The assumption had been that Conrad would pass on his near-controlling interest in the company to Baron, or at the very least that he'd spread it among family members. Instead, Conrad Hilton used his will to disenfranchise his children and grandchildren. At the time of his death, Conrad's stock in Hilton was worth perhaps $500 million. But Conrad believed very strongly that inherited wealth destroys moral character and motivation. I happen to agree that it often does. To me, it makes sense to put money in trust for your children, so they don't inherit millions of dollars when they turn 21. But Conrad took that view to a ridiculous extreme. He left Baron a token number of shares of stock, and he left each of his grandchildren a piddling $10,000 each. Nearly all the rest of his wealth, specifically his 27% share of the Hilton Corporation, he left to the Conrad N. Hilton Foundation. He ordered most of the earnings from the stake to be used to support the charitable work of Catholic nuns in California. The result was to make Baron just another high-level corporate manager who lacked the power of a major stockholder. Even with the stock options that he exercised over 10 years as chief executive, Baron still owned only a tiny percentage of the company by 1985. What Baron did was to enter into litigation, seeking control of the foundation's shares. His chances of winning the case, which had dragged on for years, were uncertain. For one thing, he had the sort of adversaries you want to avoid in a litigation, nuns and priests of the Catholic Church. Conrad's will had specified that if for any reason the foundation was unable to accept his stock bequest, Baron had the right to purchase the stock at its market value as of 1979. Federal law prohibits charitable foundations and their affiliated parties from together owning more than 20% of a public company. Therefore, Baron could legitimately argue that he was entitled to purchase for himself the 7% of the foundation's shares that were in excess of the foundation's allowable 20%. But Baron tried to take his claim much further. Basically, he tried to argue that for Byzantine legal reasons, he was entitled to buy out the foundation's entire stake. Moreover, by buying its stock for the 1979 price of 24 5/8, at a time when the stock was trading around 72, in effect, he'd be paying $170 million for $500 million worth of stock. It's called a great deal. It may also be called trying to rewrite your father's will. My strong suspicion is that Baron knew his chances of winning the litigation were questionable. More to the point, if he couldn't get control of the stock, he was in a far weaker position to fend off Steve Wynn or any hostile takeover threat. Finally, so long as he held on to his Atlantic City facility but remained unlicensable, he was also highly vulnerable to shareholder lawsuits. I have no doubt how I would have reacted if I had been Baron Hilton. I would have fought Steve Wynn in his takeover threat, and I would have also fought for my license at the rehearing. I'm not saying I would also have won, but if I went down, it would have been kicking and screaming. I would have closed the hotel and let it rot. That's just my makeup. I fight when I feel I'm getting screwed, even if it's costly and difficult and highly risky. But then, I wasn't running a public company, so I didn't have to worry constantly about Wall Street and shareholders and the next quarterly earnings report. The only person I had to please was myself. In the end, I think, Baron decided that he just wasn't prepared to fight on two fronts at the same time, for licensing as well as for control of his company. And of the two, control of the company obviously came first. Steve Wynn helped me in two ways. By pursuing a takeover, he put Baron on the defensive and kept him from focusing on his relicensing hearings. At the same time, the more Wynn's aggressive style offended Baron, the more likely it was that Baron would turn to me as a white knight. It's not a role I'm accustomed to, but Wynn played right into my hand. Wynn grew up in his father's bingo parlor, the son of a compulsive gambler. Later, he made the right friends in Las Vegas, managed to buy a small stake in the Golden Nugget Hotel, and eventually took over. His entire world has been Las Vegas and Atlantic City and gaming. He's got a great act. He's a smooth talker, he's perfectly manicured, and he's invariably dressed to kill in $2,000 suits and $200 silk shirts. The problem with Wynn is that he tries too hard to look perfect, and a lot of people are put off by him. Baron Hilton was one. It's hard to imagine two people with more different styles. Baron is a member of what I call the Lucky Sperm Club. He was born wealthy and bred to be an aristocrat. And he is one of those guys who never had to prove anything to anyone. He doesn't try to impress with his style or his clothing or anything else. If Steve Wynn tries too hard, it might be said that Baron Hilton doesn't try hard enough. Although Steve would probably never admit it, I'm convinced that he thought he was in a no-lose situation when he launched his takeover bid against Hilton. I believe Steve figured he'd end up buying Hilton's Atlantic City hotel, and quite possibly at a favorable price. Many people thought that the hotel was all Steve really wanted. There was even a certain logic to it. Under siege from all sides, Baron could kill two birds with one stone by dealing with Steve. He could say, "Look, I'll sell you my hotel if you'll agree to give up trying to get control of my company." But Steve Wynn underestimated how much he'd become anathema to Baron. That's where I came in. One day after Wynn made his takeover bid, Baron Hilton became much more serious about negotiating with me. My first offer to Hilton was $250 million. As big a number as that is, I knew Baron wasn't going to sell for that price. He told me when we first met that he had $320 million invested in the facility. Selling out at any price was a horrible prospect for him, but reporting to shareholders that he'd taken a loss on the facility was out of the question. Within a couple of days, I raised my price to $320 million. There was no time to be cute and no room to be tough in this negotiation. Either I bid the price or I walked away. At the time, $320 million, or even $250 million, represented by far the biggest gamble I'd ever taken in my life. Just a year earlier, I'd completed construction on the boardwalk facility for less than $220 million. In that case, Holiday financed the entire deal and guaranteed me against operating losses. This time, the risk was entirely mine. As soon as I decided to bid $320 million, I called John Torrell, a good friend who is president of Manufacturers Hanover Trust. We'd already done a great deal of business together, and on this occasion, we had an amazingly short conversation. "John," I said, "I'm calling because I have an opportunity to buy the incredible Hilton facility in Atlantic City for $320 million. I'd like you to lend me the money, and I'm going to need it within a week." John asked me a couple of questions, and after 2 minutes, he said, "We have a deal." Just like that. It goes to show you the value of credibility. In return, I did something I'd never done before. I personally guaranteed the loan. It was a deal based almost entirely on my gut. I made my bid without ever walking through the hotel. Several of my people had taken a look, and I'd gotten to know a lot about the construction from contractors who'd worked on the facility. However, I felt it wouldn't be appropriate to show up myself in the middle of all the turmoil Hilton was going through. If I told my father the story, he would have said I'd lost my mind. I remember very well as a kid, accompanying my father to inspect buildings he was considering buying in Brooklyn. We might have been talking about a $100,000 or $200,000 purchase price, but our inspections were anything but casual. We'd spend hours in the building, checking every refrigerator and sink, looking over the boiler and the roof and the lobby. Nor would my father have been alone in his horror. In past situations, opinion about deals I was considering had usually been split. In this case, nearly everyone I talked to opposed the deal. I was having enough trouble on the boardwalk with Holiday Inns, they pointed out. I had no management for this huge new facility scheduled to open in 2 months. I'd have to take on huge financial risk personally. I had only a verbal commitment from Manny Hanny, and it wasn't clear what conditions they might ultimately add when documents were drawn, or whether they'd have second thoughts about the whole deal. There was even considerable doubt that the market could support another major facility, particularly one that would have to carry a huge debt service at a time when interest rates were still quite high. "Why," everyone said to me, "when I even consider this deal?" For one reason only. I believe that, managed well, it had the potential to earn a ton of money. Once we agreed on a price, we still had 1,000 other smaller points to negotiate before we could sign a formal purchase and sale agreement. On April 14, 1985, We sat down in Jerry Schrager's offices at 101 Park Avenue with the lawyers from both sides to get the deal done. Often, the easiest part of a deal is price. It's all the other points. In this case, guarantees about construction completion, responsibility for defects, size of deposit, allocation of expenses between contract and closing, that end up creating problems and killing deals. Hilton, from the very start, was taking a fairly hard line. Basically, they wanted to sell the hotel as is, so that when the contracts were signed, they could walk away from Atlantic City with no further obligations. Barron, by this time, was almost rabid in his hatred of New Jersey, and particularly Atlantic City. The sooner he could put this nightmare behind him, the happier he'd be. The problem for me was that if I didn't win some guarantees about completion of construction, I risked getting killed later on. Say, for example, that it turned out that there was a major defect in the plumbing, or the air conditioning system, and I was forced to rip it out. In a building this size, a major repair could easily run to many millions of dollars. Early on in the negotiations, we seemed to be winning on the deal points that we cared about. But then, about midway through, the person in charge of Hilton's negotiations, Gregory Dillon, the executive vice president of the company, got a call from Barron Hilton, who was back in San Francisco. When Dillon returned to the table, the whole tenor of the negotiation suddenly changed. I can't say for certain, but it's my strong suspicion that Barron had decided he wanted out of the deal, in all likelihood because he'd gotten the last-minute offer for more money. It's even possible that the offer came from Steve Wynn and the Golden Nugget. In any case, Dillon and the Hilton lawyer suddenly began to raise questions about deal points that we'd agreed on. I'd been in a lot of negotiations, and I sensed immediately that they were trying to use these points as deal-breakers. If we couldn't agree on completion guarantees, for example, then they could walk away from the table without appearing to have welched on the deal merely because they'd been offered a better price. We reached something of an impasse. Greg Dillon made a suggestion. "We're not getting anywhere," he said. "So let's break this up, and we'll come back tomorrow and continue." On the face of it, the suggestion made sense. It was early on Saturday morning. We'd been in the offices around the clock for nearly 48 hours, and everyone was totally exhausted and nearly incoherent. But my fear was that if we put off the negotiations for a full day, the deal would never get done. As a compromise, I suggested we take a break for several hours and get back together about 1 p.m. The Hilton people agreed, and we broke up. At that point, my lawyers made one more attempt to convince me to let the deal die, gracefully. In particular, Jerry Schrager was concerned about the financing. Even at that point, we didn't have a formal signed commitment letter from manufacturers Hanover. But to me, a verbal commitment from John Torrell was as good as a signed commitment. Jerry's point was that even if the commitment was firm, the guarantees I was being asked to make might make it hard for me to borrow money for other large deals. It was a very strange situation. As I sat in Jerry's office, I wasn't sure who was more eager to break up the deal, my lawyers or theirs. As it turned out, the Hilton team was more than 2 hours late in getting back, which only confirmed my suspicions. By the time they finally showed up, around 3:30, I was convinced that the only way I'd get the deal done was to shame them into doing it. I stood up and began my pitch. How could they shake my hand and then not stand by the commitment? How could they negotiate for 3 days and then walk away? How could they force me to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on lawyers and not follow through? It was a disgrace, I said. It was immoral. It was wrong. It was dishonorable. My tone was more hurt than outraged or angry. I can be a screamer when I want to be. But in this case, I felt screaming would only scare them off. Much of the deal had already been negotiated, and under the circumstances, unless I gave Hilton a good excuse, it would be hard psychologically for them to walk away. It's also possible, of course, that Hilton's hard line was all a pose, a way of trying to ensure that they close the deal with as few contingencies as possible. In the end, we reached a compromise. They would use their best efforts to ready the hotel for opening, and they'd agree to completion of a specific punch list of unfinished items. Also, they would allow me to hold back $5 million of the purchase price, subject to the facilities being delivered complete and in first-class condition, as defined in specific terms in the contract. I assumed the construction was sound. If it turned out that I was wrong, and the defects I discovered ended up costing an additional $30 million, I believed Hilton would still be legally responsible. At 9 p.m. on April 27, 1985, we shook hands and signed a formal contract. I turned over a non-refundable $20 million deposit, and we set our closing for 60 days later. On May 1st, I made my first visit to the facility I'd just purchased for $320 million. As soon as I walked in, I sensed I'd made a good decision. Much work remained to be done, but it was a spectacular-looking building. Immediately, I began pushing all my people very hard. Over the next 6 weeks, we managed to accomplish what it had taken most other casinos as much as a year or more to do. We got our temporary certificate of occupancy. We finished the vast paperwork for our licensing. We hired 1,500 employees over and above those Hilton had hired, and we got the hotel and casino ready for opening. We also settled on the name Trump's Castle. My first choice had actually been Trump Palace, but then Caesar's Palace filed for an injunction on the grounds that it had exclusive rights to the name Palace. I decided it just wasn't worth a battle. We needed to get marketing and advertising campaigns underway, and the last thing I wanted was to be forced to make a name change after we'd already spent millions promoting Trump Palace. Ironically, no sooner did I announce my intention to call the facility Trump's Castle than Holiday Inns filed their own suit to prevent me from using the name Trump at all on a competitive casino. Within weeks, however, the suit was thrown out. Even before we opened Trump's Castle, I began discussions with several investment banking firms about floating a bond issue to replace my bank financing from manufacturers Hanover. I wanted to take myself off the hook personally, even if it meant paying a higher interest rate to do so. The major problem with floating a bond issue was that Trump's Castle had no performance record by which anyone could calculate how much debt it could reasonably handle. Also, the Trump Organization had no track record running a casino, since we'd yet to manage one ourselves. In short, anyone who bought Trump's Castle bonds was making a leap of faith. They were betting that we'd make the facility highly successful from the start. That was the only way we could meet a debt service in the range of $40 million a year. To put that in context, there were several existing casinos in town that couldn't come close to supporting that kind of debt service. Somewhat to my surprise, several investment banking firms bid for the right to handle my offering. In return for a percentage of the total offering, they would guarantee to find buyers for the bonds at a specified price. Among the bidders was Drexel Burnham, which invented the concept of high-yield junk bond financing. But Bear Stearns, with whom I'd already done a lot of business, offered to raise $300 million, or nearly 95% of the total I needed. Alan Greenberg, the chairman, and Paul Hallingby, managing partner, were willing to bet big on me, and I liked that. To attract buyers for a speculative offering like this one, you generally have to offer the inducement of a high yield. The bonds Bear Stearns prepared carried about the same yield as other casinos had offered on their own financings. But those casinos had track records and offered far stronger guarantees to buyers. Bear Stearns did a fabulous job. I got a good deal, but so did the buyers. Anyone who bought the bonds is earning an exceptionally good return, and the bonds are now selling at a premium. The one thing I wanted to avoid, above all, was a repetition of the sort of problems we had from the beginning at the Boardwalk facility. Rather than hire an outside general manager, I decided to put my wife, Ivana, in charge. I'd studied Atlantic City long enough to be convinced that when it comes to running a casino, good management skills are as important as specific gaming experience. She proved me right. By closing the deal with Hilton on June 15th, we were able to take advantage of the high summer season. The next day, we opened, without a hitch, as Trump's castle. People packed the casino, and we did extraordinary business, way beyond our expectations. On our first day, we earned gross gaming revenues of $728,000. For the slightly less than 6 months we were open during 1985, we grossed just over $131 million. That was better than all but three of our competitors, and far better than the Boardwalk facility had done for the same period under Harris. The one difficulty that arose in the early months had to do with the clause in my contract with Hilton regarding delivery of the hotel in first-class condition. Under the contract, $5 million of my purchase price was held back pending completion of all work. As time went on, however, we discovered that there were numerous outstanding problems. With the cooling tower, the sewage system, the computer system, and the fire alarm, among others. During the first 6 months we were open, my representatives and Hilton's quietly negotiated about exactly which defects Hilton was responsible for and which they were not. My people felt strongly that the items not satisfactorily completed ran to considerably more than $5 million. On the other hand, I was eager to resolve the matter amicably. I liked Baron Hilton. I felt sorry about his experience in Atlantic City. And for months, I was the first to defend him in any conversation. As a result, when the argument over who owed money to whom seemed to be getting nowhere, I decided to call Baron myself in January 1986. I got him on the phone, and I said that since our disputes hadn't been resolved, perhaps we should sit down together and work out some reasonable settlement. Baron seemed delighted that I had called. He said that he would be in New York the following Monday or Tuesday, and that he would call me then to set a date. Instead, when I came into my office on Monday morning, I was served with a lawsuit from Hilton, seeking immediate payment of the $5 million the contract authorized us to hold back. I couldn't believe it. The first thing I did was to call Baron again. "I don't understand this," I said. "I've just been served with a lawsuit, even though you told me we'd sit down and work this out together this week." Baron totally stonewalled me. "I don't know anything about a suit," he said. He suggested that I call Greg Dillon, Hilton's executive vice president. Incredibly, Dillon took the same position, that he knew nothing about the suit. Not for 1 minute did I believe that both Baron Hilton and his top deputy would be ignorant of a major lawsuit filed by the company. I recognize that lawsuits are sometimes inevitable, and I accept that as a reality of business. But when a person tells me he's going to sit down with me, I expect him to honor that commitment. If we still can't resolve the situation, that's another story. From that day on, I stopped defending Baron Hilton to anyone. I also immediately ordered my attorneys to file a counterclaim. On April 2, 1986, we did precisely that, listing 94 separate deficiencies in the castle, along with our estimated cost of repair. The figure far exceeded the $5 million we'd been authorized to hold back. Both suits are still pending, and I believe that we'll ultimately be upheld. But for that one sour note, the story of Trump's castle has been almost entirely a positive one. Much of the credit has to go to Ivana. No detail escapes her. She has systematically hired the best people in Atlantic City at all levels, from croupiers to hosts to her top executives. She oversaw the decoration of the hotel's public spaces, which are now quite spectacular. The facility is always spotless, because she's meticulous even about that. And great management pays off. In 1986, we grossed $226 million. A record for first-year operations. We are projecting revenues of $310 million, and a gross operating profit well in excess of $70 million. It pays to trust your instincts. Chapter 10. Low Rent, High Stakes. The Showdown on Central Park South. Sometimes by losing a battle, you find a new way to win the war. What you need, generally, is enough time and a little luck. I had both at 100 Central Park South. This is a story about a group of tenants who fought very hard to keep me from tearing down the building they lived in and constructing a new one in its place. They succeeded. But by delaying me for several years, during which real estate values soared, and by forcing me to totally change my original plans, they inadvertently helped me come up with a less expensive and more profitable project. Ironically, the easiest part of the whole deal was buying the property. Early in 1981, Louise Sunshine, my executive vice president at the time, came in to say she'd heard there might be an opportunity to buy two adjoining buildings in a great location. The first was 100 Central Park South, a 14-story residential building on the corner of Central Park South and Avenue of the Americas. The other was the Barbizon Plaza, a 39-story hotel which fronted on Central Park and wrapped around behind 100 Central Park South, so that the east side of the hotel faced Avenue of the Americas. The buildings were owned by a syndicate that included Marshall Loeb of the Loeb Banking Family, the Lambert Brussels Corporation, and Henry Greenberg. By virtue of their location, the buildings represented one of the best pieces of real estate anywhere in the world. In addition to being on one of the city's widest and most elegant streets, the buildings looked out over Central Park. The Barbizon Plaza was a somewhat run-down middle-price hotel, earning a modest profit at best. 100 Central Park South was a building filled with rent-controlled and rent-stabilized apartments, meaning that the rent roll was barely sufficient to cover the operating costs of the building. Precisely because of these disadvantages, I was able to negotiate a very favorable purchase price. It helped that the properties hadn't yet been put up for sale on the open market. As long as there were no other bidders, it was much easier for me to make a case that the building's problems decreased their value. It probably also helped that the owners were a group of very wealthy men who had decided to sell, not because they needed the money, but because one of them was getting older and wanted to put his estate in order. I'm not permitted to say what I paid, but the sum wouldn't be enough today to buy a vacant lot one-third the size in a far less desirable part of Manhattan. I barely looked at what the two buildings were earning. I was drawn to the real estate value, not the income. I was buying a great location at a modest price. And the way I looked at the deal, there was virtually no downside. Almost immediately, I was able to get a mortgage for the buildings, which covered my purchase price. In the worst case, I felt, I could always turn around and sell at a profit. Even in bad times, there are buyers for first-class locations. Another option was to do a modest renovation of the hotel and raise the rents on the ground floor stores to market levels as their leases came up. In addition, as tenants in rent-controlled and rent-stabilized apartments passed away or moved out of 100 Central Park South, I could raise the rents on those apartments. Even by doing these relatively minor things, I could earn at least a modest return on my investment. But then, modest isn't my favorite word. The way to derive the most value from the site, I believed, was to knock down both buildings and to construct in their place one huge, beautiful, modern luxury condominium tower. That posed two problems. The first, which I recognized from the start, is that it's neither easy nor cheap to demolish a 44-story building such as the Barbizon. Still, I was certain that the prices we'd be able to get for new apartments in such a premium location would more than justify any added demolition costs. The second problem, which I didn't fully understand until much later, is that it's almost impossible to legally vacate a building filled with rent-controlled and rent-stabilized apartments. I knew that some tenants were sure to resist moving, but I figured time was on my side. I could afford delay. I was prepared to be as patient and as persistent as I needed to be. What I underestimated was how much the tenants stood to lose. I soon came to understand a simple axiom. The lower the rent, the bigger the apartment, and the better the location, the harder people will fight to keep what they have. It's no great hardship to consider moving if you're living in a mediocre apartment in a marginal neighborhood. Likewise, if you're paying market rent for a good apartment, and you can find a comparable one at the same price, a small financial inducement will often prompt you to move. But at 100 Central Park South, many tenants were fighting to protect the ultimate in New York real estate. Beautiful apartments with high ceilings, fireplaces, and great views at an unbeatable location. Most important, with rent control and rent stabilization, they were enjoying one of the great windfall subsidies in the free world. On the open market, their apartments would have rented for as much as 10 times what they were paying. If I'd been a tenant at 100 Central Park South, I'd have led the fight against anyone who tried to get me to move. Unfortunately, rent control is a disaster for all but the privileged minority who are protected by it. As much as any other single factor, rent control is responsible for the desperate housing crisis that has plagued New York City for the past 20 years. Like a lot of failed government programs, rent control grew out of a decent idea that ended up achieving exactly the opposite of its intended effect. Rent control began as a temporary federal policy in 1943. The government froze rent on every apartment in America as a way to provide affordable housing for returning veterans. Having achieved that, the law was rescinded in 1948. But New York City adopted its own rent control law in 1962. Under the city statute, any dwelling built before 1947 was subject to rent control. In effect, the city created an inalienable right for 5 million New Yorkers, namely low-price housing. It sounds wonderful. The only problem was that the city had no intention of underwriting it. Instead, they forced landlords to subsidize tenants. The costs of fuel, labor, and maintenance rose steadily. But the city refused to let landlords raise their rents to keep pace with inflation, much less the market itself. When landlords simply couldn't make ends meet anymore, they began abandoning their buildings. Between 1960 and 1976, approximately 300,000 housing units in New York were abandoned. The first apartments to go, either by abandonment or arson, were the ones in the worst neighborhoods. Apartments in these buildings had the lowest rents. Landlords, therefore, earned the smallest profit margins and were least able to absorb rising costs. The other victims were the poor tenants who had been living in these buildings. Whole neighborhoods in the South Bronx and Brooklyn turned into ghost towns. The city, in turn, lost hundreds of millions of dollars in real estate taxes that landlords stopped paying once they'd abandoned their buildings. Perhaps the worst thing about rent control is that it stopped protecting the people who needed it the most. The best rent-controlled apartments have always been prized and difficult to come by, and people with power and money have always had an inside track on them. During the past year, an independent researcher and writer, William Tucker, has set out to document particularly egregious examples. He cites buildings such as one on Central Park West at 73rd Street. Magnificently designed, it has huge apartments, wonderful detailing, a beautiful double-height marble lobby, and of course, gorgeous views. It's no surprise that people with money and taste would want to live there. Mia Farrow, for example, has 10 rooms overlooking the park. She pays about $2,000 a month for an apartment that might rent for upward of $10,000 a month on the open market. Carly Simon, the singer and songwriter, lives in the same building and pays about $2,200 a month for her 10 rooms overlooking the park. Down the street, Tucker found that Suzanne Farrell of the New York City Ballet has a 14-room duplex near Lincoln Center, for which she pays under $1,000 a month. William Vandenhoevel, a very prominent attorney who served as ambassador to the United Nations under Jimmy Carter, pays less than $650 a month for a 6-room apartment in a terrific building on East 72nd Street near Fifth Avenue. Alastair Cook, the TV personality, pays about $1,100 for an 8-room apartment on Fifth Avenue. William Shawn, former editor of The New Yorker, lives in the same building, and pays $1,000 a month for his 8 rooms. The most notorious example of all may be Ed Koch, the mayor of New York. Koch has a very nice 3-room rent-controlled apartment with a terrace in a beautiful part of Greenwich Village. He pays $350 a month, perhaps 1/5 of what it's worth. The worst thing, though, is that Koch doesn't even live in his rent-controlled apartment. He lives in Gracie Mansion, the official residence of the mayor. Unlike most developers, I don't advocate eliminating rent control. I just think there ought to be a means test for anyone living in a rent-controlled apartment. People below a certain income would be permitted to keep their apartments at their current rent. People with incomes above a certain sum would be given a choice between paying a proportionally higher rent for their apartments or moving somewhere else. The situation at 100 Central Park South is a perfect illustration. Soon after I purchased the building, I did some research into the financial status of the tenants. What I discovered was fascinating, but not surprising. There are 3 distinct groups. The first, who live in the largest apartments, overlooking the park, on the higher floors, are generally successful, wealthy, and in some cases quite prominent. Fashion designer Arnold Scazzi, for example, has a 6-room duplex facing the park, for which he is paying $985 a month, about what it costs to rent a 1-room studio at market rates. Angelo DiSapio, another wealthy tenant and an architect of some eminence, has the entire 7th floor facing the park, 9 rooms, for a rent of $1,600 a month. Still another tenant owns a beautiful brownstone on 63rd Street with at least $5 million, but also has 4 combined apartments at 100 Central Park South with fabulous views of the park from the 13th floor and a rent under $2,500 a month. All of these apartments could rent for many times what the current wealthy occupants are paying. The second group of tenants are what I'd call the yuppies. Younger professional people, stockbrokers and journalists and attorneys. While not necessarily millionaires, these people are certainly affluent. A good number of them occupy 1- and 2-bedroom apartments facing the park. The third group of tenants live in smaller apartments with tiny kitchens and windows facing the court. Not surprisingly, these people are generally of modest means. A number of them are elderly, living on Social Security. Their rents are below market, but not nearly to the degree of their wealthier neighbors in the front apartments. A comparable studio in the neighborhood might rent for twice what most of these tenants are now paying. The leader of the tenants, John Moore, was a man who didn't quite fit into any group. In his early 40s, this gentleman came from a family of money and social standing. His grandfather was a major stockholder in Tiffany & Company before it was bought by Walter Hoving, but he himself had not been very successful. I've always been convinced that leading the tenants gave him a way to feel useful and important. Of course, he also had something very valuable to protect, a beautiful 2-bedroom Park View apartment for which he paid a very modest rent. Vacating the Barbizon Plaza was easy. All I had to do was stop renting hotel rooms. Before I gave up that income, however, I wanted to vacate 100 Central Park South, too. Unfortunately, I made a very critical mistake right at the start. I should have gotten involved myself. That's what I'd always done in the past, and that's what always worked for me. But frankly, convincing tenants to move wasn't the kind of work I relished. Instead, I decided to hire a company that specialized in relocating tenants. Citadel Management was recommended to me by several top executives at well-known companies who'd used the firm and vouched for its reputation. I wasn't looking for tough guys. This was a high-visibility location, and a lot of people were gunning for Donald Trump already. The last thing I needed was to create controversy. My original plan was very straightforward. We'd let the tenants at 100 Central Park South know that we intended to eventually demolish the building, along with the Barbizon next door. Then we'd offer them help in finding suitable new apartments, as well as cash incentives to move. Very quickly, however, the tenants got organized. They formed a tenants' association and decided to hire a law firm to represent them. Cost was no object. The wealthiest tenants had the most money to lose, and they were more than willing to underwrite any attorney fees. Several agreed to contribute as much as $8,000 a year to the cause. That was cheap, after all, compared with the $10,000 a month they might have to pay for a comparable apartment elsewhere. The firm that the tenants chose had been somewhat successful representing tenants facing eviction. They made a better living than most landlord attorneys. Their approach was to resist eviction on every front and tie things up in court for as long as possible, perhaps hoping to make as big a settlement as possible with the landlord. I felt confident that I had every legal right to vacate 100 Central Park South for the purpose of building a new and larger building in its place. To evict the tenants who lived in non-rent-controlled apartments, all I had to show was my plans to demolish the building and put up a new one in its place. To evict the tenants under rent control, I had to meet stricter standards, but none that seemed insurmountable. First, I had to demonstrate that my new building would provide at least 20% more housing units than the old one. That was easy enough, since it was obviously in my interest financially to put up a bigger building. Second, I had to prove that the old building was earning a profit, after expenses, of less than 8.5% of its assessed value. By virtue of rent control, the assessment was a paltry $1.5 million, meaning the city got almost no taxes from the building. And although I wasn't permitted to include my debt service as part of my expenses, the building still didn't come close to earning an 8.5% margin. If my debt service was included, I was actually losing a substantial amount of money. Either way, if the city ruled purely on the merits, I was convinced they'd have to approve our demolition application and order any remaining tenants out. When Citadel took over management of the building early in 1981, I gave them two instructions. The first was to try to find new apartments for as many tenants as possible. The second was to continue to provide all essential services to the tenants. It happens to be very easy to vacate a building if, like so many landlords, you don't mind being a bad guy. When these landlords buy buildings they intend to vacate, they use corporate names that are difficult to trace. Then they hire thugs to come in with sledgehammers and smash up the boiler, rip out the stairways, and create floods by cutting holes in pipes. They import truckloads of junkies, prostitutes, and thieves, and move them into vacant apartments to terrorize holdout tenants. That's what I call harassment. I wouldn't have done that sort of thing for moral reasons, nor would I have done it for practical reasons. I buy buildings in my own name, and I have a reputation to uphold. The tenants at 100 Park South got an abundance of heat and plenty of hot water. I made sure to deal with the building's outstanding violations, however modest, even though you'll find dozens of violations in elegant buildings all over the Upper East Side. The last thing I wanted was to give these tenants legitimate grounds for opposing me. What I didn't do was run 100 Central Park South as if it were a white-glove Park Avenue building. The rent roll, which barely covered my basic expenses, simply couldn't support luxuries. Nor did tenants paying tiny, below-market rents have any right to expect them. For example, when we took over, there was a telephone in the lobby. Not a pay telephone, but a free telephone. It was supposed to be for emergencies. It turned out that some tenants were using the phone to call their friends in Gstaad and St. Moritz. The doormen were taken out of their fancy uniforms. That saved a small fortune in dry-cleaning bills. To ensure security, the doorman stopped leaving the door to meet tenants halfway down the street to carry their packages. High-wattage lights in the hallways were replaced with lower-wattage bulbs. Because, as any cost-conscious landlord will tell you, that alone saves many thousand dollars a year in electric bills. What we didn't anticipate was that the tenants would try to use the fact that we were running the building more efficiently as evidence that we were harassing them and making their lives intolerable. In a way, it was fitting. We were talking about at least some people, after all, for whom hardship is not being able to get a table on 30 minutes' notice at Le Cirque. If there's one thing I've learned about the rich, it's that they have a very low threshold for even the mildest discomfort. The tenants even figured out a way to turn our relocation offer into evidence of harassment. We were, they claimed, using persistent